You're listening to heritageradionetwork.org. This is a live recording from the Roger Smith Cookbook Conference.
Hey, it's Jimmy Carboni with the Heritage Radio Network. I'm here live at the Roger Smith Cookbook Conference in Manhattan. And my next guest is Ken Albala. He's a panelist here. And Ken, tell us about what you do.
Sure. I'm a food historian at the University of the Pacific in Stockton, California. And I write basic food histories. My specialty is the Renaissance era. And also write cookbooks and edit encyclopedias and a journal and, you know, keep very busy.
And you're on a panel today. What panel is that?
This is on food and Christianity. And this what the paper I'm presenting is a bit of my own research about how Lenten restrictions affected food. In the Middle Ages, they're pretty strict, and they tend to loosen up by the 1490s or so, and then the Reformation sort of makes them disappear, and you get new food combinations, things like fish cooked with butter, and a general breaking down of the separation of dairy and meat products for food, for meat days, and fish and vegetables for Lent and fast days.
So tell us about Lent. So when did Lent start?
Well, it starts really like 4th, 5th century. It doesn't get codified until about the 7th century. And just in a nutshell, it means that only meat products do you eat for most of the year. And then about 100, even more than that, days of the year, the entire period of Lent, except for Sundays, every Saturday, and the vigils of saints' days, you don't eat meat at all. And the logic of this is, A, that you're being penitential, you know, and thinking about all the bad things you've done during the year. And the other idea is that meat is considered very, very nutritious. So when you eat it, it actually creates a plethora of blood in your body and ultimately of sperm, believe it or not. And this sort of stimulates your libido. So the way to stay chaste is to eat cold and, you know, fish and vegetables. And it's why monastic people generally, you know, don't eat so much meat. There's a strange medical logic to the whole thing. But what's interesting is when that breaks down, at least when people can purchase dispensations and are allowed to eat meat during, or at least dairy products for the most part, butter, then those rigid categories start to mix. And I think it really leads to modern cooking, as you find combinations of things that are more close to the way we eat than the way medieval people would have eaten.
And coming to modern era, I know that with McDonald's, they came they're in Cincinnati was very Catholic.
Yeah.
And apparently that's where they created the fish sandwich. What's the McDonald's fish sandwich?
Well, this is true. You know, and in some places where they are very strict keepers of Lent, especially Greece, there's a it's called Mixarakosti burger or something like that, made of vegetables. So, you know, I think for nowadays, the few people who still keep Lent on Fridays, you know, Lent and fast on Fridays, fish is pretty easy option to, you know, choose. But in the past, it was difficult. You know, if you lived in a place that was inland, or you, you know, had a store of meats and butter and stuff, and suddenly told you have to find fish, it would have been a real privation. And in fact, I think far more important in the whole Reformation in general, this is hopefully what is going to come out of the next academic monograph that I write, will be these sort of food fights that happen in the Reformation over what you're supposed to be eating and what you're not. Because, of course, in the New Testament, there are no food rules. That's the whole idea, is when they break away from Judaism, they're conscious about not keeping kosher, about not having all those complex rules. And, you know, it's all through the Bible. Even Jesus says it's not what goes into the mouth, but what comes out of the mouth that defiles a person. So they really don't want food rules at all. And then they slowly come back. And especially, you know, in the latter Middle Ages, they're very complex. Some days you're allowed butter, some days you're not, some days, you know, eggs are forbidden. So it's pretty complex. And I think it certainly has a huge impact on medieval cooking, because you find people inventing things to substitute for dairy products. For example, almond milk is a huge ingredient in late medieval cooking. We tend to think, oh, it's, you know, something, a modern invention, and it's for
Whole
people
Foods.
Who are, exactly, and unfortunately, the stuff they sell at Whole Foods is pretty bad. I mean, it's sweetened and, you know, flavored with almond extract and stuff like that. To make almond milk out of almonds, it really tastes like milk. It's startling how much it behaves like it. You can make butter out of it, you can make cheese out of it.
How did they make almond butter back then?
Well, it's not the same product that we have today. Today, almonds are just ground up, and it's like peanut butter, right? What they would have done is grind the raw almonds, add hot water, and then pour it off, much the same way you make cheese or you make tofu. It's made the same way. And then you have this very thick milk, and then you coagulate that, and then you drain off the solids, or you separate the butter from, you know, the oil from the almond, and you have a kind of almond butter, which is really nice. I mean, it's a fat, basically.
Have you been part of any like reenactments of medieval food?
I do a lot of cooking of this period, sure. Because I think if you're going to get a good sense of what the cooking is like, you really have to do it. You have to taste it. You have to go through the procedures. So a lot of what I do is very, very much hands-on, using the original equipment. And that's pretty much what the cookbooks I've written are about, more or less. They're things that people don't do anymore, like making cheese, curing meat, distilling alcohol, pickling, things that would have been pretty commonplace even a few hundred years ago, and now industry does them, and I think they're just pretty much inferior. So it's, you know, I hope I'm kind of riding this trend of do-it-yourself and, you know, moving away from technology and moving away from very expensive ingredients and exotic things. And I think what the coming trend, or at least it's in place now, is for people to make things themselves again.
Well, that's great. I definitely see that trend happening too. Yeah. One thing I like to see is how people used to use like pork fat or beef fat in their pastries.
Totally. It makes an incredible difference. Suet in a pastry crust is magnificent, and it's actually pretty hard to find, I think, at least where I live. Lard is a weird story because it was once a universal cooking medium, you know, and when margarine was introduced, they really did a smear campaign, literally, right, in this case, and just told everyone lard is really awful for you and blah, 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 blah. Fat is fat, has same calories, same everything, and, you know, it was just a quirk of fate that we found out margarine turns out to be really, really bad for you. You know, trans fat, everyone would much better off eating lard to start with, you know, apart from the fact that it just tastes wonderful. It makes a beautiful flaky crust, and you know, it's a shame it's gone out of our repertoire, really.
You know, my father was born in 1920, and the last time I cooked for him before he died a few years ago, I had made bacon for breakfast, and I said just leave the bacon fat in the pan, and then I cooked him his steak for lunch, and as soon as he had the first bite, the smile came over his face and he said, "This reminds me of the flavors of my mother's food."
Sure.
And it's because she was cooking and pork fat.
That's right. You never throw away anything. You know, people in the past were much more frugal because fat is food, it's good calories, you know, and if you're doing heavy work, certainly there's no reason to throw that away. And it's a storable form of fat also. People don't realize nowadays, you know, most of the things that people did out of necessity in the past, like making bacon or pickling vegetables or something, was just because you had a ton of them and you wanted them to last through the year, so you put them up either by salting or pickling or smoking or, you know, a whole slew of preservative means. And today we do it for flavor. Obviously, you know, we miss those flavors. And I think for some things, there's kind of a hardwired preference in us as a species for things that we have been doing for thousands of years. Smoking especially, you know, that lovely flavor you get from bacon or smoked food, ham, things like that. I think we are, in a sense, evolved to like those things. Salty food also, really sour foods. You know, they're things that by necessity we've been eating for a long time, and for good reason, they're good.
And how did you get started in this? Because you're onto something. I mean, I think more and more people are interested in historical foods. I haven't never met anyone who's talked about it the way you do.
Well,
how did you get started in this?
Gosh, you know, I was a grad school at Columbia, and my dissertation advisor said, you have to pick a topic. And I figured I might as well do something that I'm going to enjoy and not get tired of reading for many years. And in fact, I went to Columbia, so he told me, go across the park to the New York Academy of Medicine and see what they have there. And I'm like, why? I wasn't doing medicine at all. And he said, they have very comfortable chairs. this was his criteria. But I just happened to have found a huge cache of nutritional theory from about 1450 to 1650. And so I just read it all. And that became my dissertation. And that became my first book. And I guess, you know, I sort of slid from there more into culinary matters. And reading cookbooks is great. It tells you all sorts of things about social structure and who's doing the cooking and what ingredients they can get and trade networks and things like that. But really what I became interested in was the taste. What did they actually taste? And, you know, obviously some ingredients have changed a lot. The pigs we breed today are not those of the past. The vegetables are hybrid and bred for certain characteristics. But I still think we can come pretty close, especially if we use the same technologies that they did and don't cut corners and don't substitute ingredients. And I think it should be considered like any other art form. You know, if you're going to appreciate Rembrandt, you want to see the actual painting, understand the techniques. And I think to just read a cookbook is sort of, you're missing something. You're missing the whole art, really, is in the tasting.
So you're saying if I was going to make medieval food, the flavors would be things like using whole animals, the fats from animals, simple vegetables.
It's partly that. It's also flavor combinations we don't use anymore, so a lot more spices, things like nutmeg and cloves, and things that we think of as, you know, apple pie spices, a lot more vinegar or verre juice, which is unripe grape juice. So the flavors are more piquant, so there's a lot more contrast of flavors. When we put food together, we tend to think that the ingredients should complement the main ingredients. So if you have like a chicken, you want to have a chicken-based broth to make a stock, to make a sauce that goes on it. That's completely foreign to most medieval and even early modern cooking for the first few centuries, is that they wanted things that contrast with the main flavor ingredient. So you have a lot of acids and a lot of spiciness, closer to Indian food, oddly enough.
So and what about any other modern cuisines? Like, what about Sicily or North Africa?
Well, there's tons of, I mean, obviously Sicily has a million different influences, you know, the Arabs, the French influences there, Italian influence, and being a Mediterranean place, there, it's always been a crossroads. So I think Sicilian food is more, sort of shows more historical influence than other cuisines, even though New World ingredients came in, like tomatoes and peppers, and just, you know, we associate that completely. But that's really pretty new. You know, I think the flavor bases are, you know, using olives and capers and wine and fresh cheeses and pasta goes back to the Middle Ages. So those, you know, I think Sicilian cooking is really, there are very interesting rudiments of earlier cooking in there. And you could say that about a lot of cooking. You know, there's weird things that show up in places and you wonder, how did this happen? Like cardamom and Swedish cookies. You know, it's a very medieval combination, but it's still there. Or even, I think, in Mexico, you know, when the Spanish take what is basically medieval Spanish cooking to Mexico, there's some things that they do, like a mole still has all sorts of spices and nuts, and obviously they're using New World ingredients like chocolate in it, too. But essentially, it's basically a medieval sauce.
Yeah, our friend Zarela Martinez, she has a book out about Oaxaca cooking, and she says there's seven moles of Oaxaca.
Oh, yeah.
And they're all made like a mortar and pestle, and it does seem, you know, so ancient.
Yeah, the traditional methods, too. I mean, the mortar itself was a standard medieval implement, and any sauce, rather than using fat to, like, elide a sauce, you know, like we would use a roux or a beurre manier to thicken something, they generally use breadcrumbs. So they throw breadcrumbs in, pound it out, and you'd get a nice thick sauce out of that. But it's something that you would never think of doing today.
Here's a throwback sauce. Okay. Do you know how to make garum from ancient Rome?
You know, I've done it myself. It's really very, very easy. There's a handful of recipes that come from a text called the Geoponica, which is 7th century Byzantine or 6th century. And essentially, you just take a whole handful of fish, entire whole fish, like tiny little anchovies or sprats, something like that, or mackerel you can use also, and you put salt on it, usually about 1/5 or 1/4 the same weight of the fish, and you forget about it. You just leave it. You don't add water. You don't add anything. And the natural enzymes inside the fish's guts digest the flesh. And you pour about a year later, you know, 6 months to a year later, you pour off the liquid. And it tastes very much like Asian fish sauce. So, you know, a nam pla or a nuoc mam. I think they're comparable. There are other kinds of garums that they used in the ancient world. Some were more like a paste, more like an anchovy paste. But it's very easy to do, and it's a shame that people don't think they can do that. They think, oh, I'm going to poison myself. You know, something's going to go wrong. And it's really it's pretty foolproof as long as you follow the ancient directions. And I think that's for most historic cooking, people are just reluctant to trust the authors themselves, you know, and they know what they're talking about. You know, they're not going to lead you astray, and they weren't poisoning themselves left and right. So I think trying historic recipes really turns out to, it's almost like a new foreign country. You know, it's a whole set of cuisines of the past that we don't know about anymore and don't understand the techniques anymore. And sometimes it's fun to just give it a shot and see what happens.
Well, I'm here with Ken Albala. I'm on the Heritage Radio Network. One last question for Ken. Ken, you know, in our modern times, people are talking about you can change your diet to improve your health. You know, and I read something recently about rheumatism or arthritis, how there's certain foods like meat and dairy to stay away from, but also they mentioned nightshades. And I was never quite sure what nightshades were, but I think in some time in the past they thought they were bad for you.
Well, they are bad for you. Nightshade is the Solanaceae family. So in the European plants in that family are belladonna and a handful of other really nasty poisons. So the other side of the family, the New World side, is tomatoes and potatoes and tobacco. They're separated by a million years, but eggplant is also solanaceous. So when those plants get to the Old World, at least the authorities are very suspicious of them because they look like poisonous plants. And have you ever felt the leaves of a tomato plant? I mean, they stink and they taste awful. And I think that people must have tried them and tasted them and said, this can't be good for you. And having said that, other people are eating them. Clearly, they get there. And in some places, just not recorded in cookbooks, people are eating them. And it's not really until the late 17th century that you find the first recipe for tomatoes, believe it or not. It's almost 200 years after they're introduced. So clearly, elite people who write cookbooks, medical physicians definitely, botanists give them a try here and there, but it's really just a botanical curiosity for them. But solanacea, yeah, I mean, what it actually does today, I couldn't tell you. And next week they'll change their mind about that too. You know, they'll say, fine, you have to eat solanacea,
potatoes are good for you. When I hear the reference to nightshades, it sounds like something from, the 1600s.
Yeah, well, nightshades are poison. Yeah, definitely.
All right. Well, this is pretty fascinating. Tell us your latest book.
Sure. My latest one is called The Lost Arts of Hearth and Home, and that's come out from Penguin. And it's mostly recipes, but there's also a section on sewing, and I built a wood-fired oven in the backyard, and dehydrators, things that are sort of household projects, and things, how to make brooms is in there, how to make your own ink and cut your own feather quill, and stuff that's really, I didn't actually know I knew how to do all this stuff until I said put it down on paper, and it turned out I've been doing this stuff all along. But it's
that sounds like a great, and tell us your name and how people can contact you.
My name is Ken Albala, and you can find me online. I've also got a blog called Ken Albala's Food Rant, and you'll see all the experiments that I'm doing every week on there.
Well, you're great, and I want to read your book. So thanks so much, Ken. And again, Jimmy Carboni on the Heritage Radio Network. We're signing off. We'll be back in a few more minutes at the Roger Smith Cookbook Conference.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, iTunes, and Stitcher for more. Visit our website, heritageradionetwork.org, for all of our 30-plus weekly podcasts. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.